Without really thinking about what he was doing, the kid reached up to tug the hat down tighter on his head. It was just a reflex action. His brain was full of worry for the family he had left. He had covered about a mile, so he was only halfway there. Despite the way the buckskin's long-legged pace ate up the ground, it seemed to take forever to get anywhere. The kid's lips pulled back from his teeth in a grimace. He shouldn't have ridden off like that, he told himself. He should have stayed to make sure Sean and Franny and Cyrus were safe. He should have known that the Colonel would be suspicious and would come back to the Williams spread sooner or later. The kid shoved those thoughts out of his head. He knew from tragic experience that all the should-haves in the world meant nothing. All that mattered was what actually happened. A column of black smoke climbed into the Arizona sky that had turned a brilliant blue with the advent of morning. The kid bit back a curse and lashed the buckskin with the reins, trying to get more speed out of the horse. The buckskin responded gallantly, stretching out even more. The landscape flashed by in a blur. Man and horse were one, racing across the flats, bounding up and down the gentle hills, wheeling tightly around obstacles. Finally, the kid realized that the horse's heart might burst if he kept up this pace. The buckskin would have run himself to death if that was what the kid asked him to do. The kid hauled back on the reins, slowing his mount a little, even though the smoke curling into the sky called out to him with a terrible urgency. It wouldn't do any good if the buckskin collapsed underneath him, he told himself. He held the horse at a hard run instead of the full-out sprint. He couldn't hear the shots anymore, but it was unlikely he'd be able to hear them over the buckskin's pounding hoofbeats, even if they continued. A long rise loomed in front of him. The kid knew that the ranch headquarters was on the other side of that rise. There was no longer any doubt about where the thick black smoke was coming from. He pulled the Winchester from its sheath as he started up the rise. If whoever had attacked the ranch was still there, he intended to make them pay for what they had done. As he topped the rise, he saw that the raiders were gone. Nothing was moving around the ranch. Smoke poured up from the house, the barn, and the bunkhouse. Those structures were made of adobe, but their interiors could burn. The corral was empty and its gate open. The raiders had taken the horses with them. The kid's heart slugged heavily in his chest as he spotted several dark shapes sprawled on the ground near the bunkhouse. The vaqueros must have run outside when the shooting started, only to be cut down. Another body lay face down near the house. The kid rode hard toward it. Maybe somebody was still alive. He knew it was a forlorn hope, but he couldn't abandon it. As he came closer, he saw a big hole in the wall of the house, as if something had smashed through it. He didn't know what could have inflicted the damage, but it didn't really matter. He hauled back on the reins and slowed the buckskin, swinging down from the saddle even before the horse came to a halt. The kid landed running, with the Winchester held ready for instant use if he needed it. He recognized the man lying face down as Sean Williams. The kid dropped to a knee beside the young rancher and set the rifle on the ground. He took hold of Sean's shoulders and carefully rolled him onto his back. The kid's hard-planed face took on an even grimmer cast as he saw how sodden with blood Sean's shirt was. The rancher was shot to pieces. But somehow, he was still alive. His eyelids flickered open. The kid slipped an arm under his shoulders and lifted him a little. He peered up at the kid without seeming to recognize him.
Franny.
It's Morgan, John. What happened?
Men rode up. Started shooting. We just sat down to breakfast. I ran to the door. Oh, God. There was a terrible noise. Something came through the wall. Franny and Cyrus were still at the table. Oh, God. No. No.
The kid glanced at the hole in the wall. If whatever had caused that destruction had gone on through and hit Franny and Cyrus, there was no way they had survived. And if they were still in the burning house, there might not even be anything left of their bodies. Sean's fingers clutched at the kid's arm.
You gotta save him. Get him out.
Sure. I'll do what I can, Sean. I swear.
But he didn't get up, knowing that there was no point. He had already seen the light fading in Sean's eyes, and a moment later, the young man's grip relaxed and his fingers slid off the kid's arm. The kid closed Sean's eyes and eased him back to the ground. The kid stood up and looked toward the house. He had promised Sean that he would do what he could for Franny and Cyrus, and he fully intended to keep that promise. He would also do the one thing that was within his power. He would avenge their deaths. The kid checked on the three vaqueros who lay near the bunkhouse and found that they were dead, also shot full of holes, just like Sean. He didn't see the fourth member of the crew, but he assumed the man's body was inside the bunkhouse, being consumed by the flames. He couldn't put out the fires. They would just have to burn themselves out. In the meantime, he covered the bodies with blankets from his bedroll to keep scavengers off them, then mounted up and rode in a large circle around the ranch headquarters. He saw numerous hoof prints, and while he wasn't an expert tracker like his father, he could tell that the men who'd attacked the ranch had approached the place from the southeast. The kid noticed something else that was odd. Two parallel lines etched into the sandy ground that looked like the tracks of wagon wheels. They were too close together to be wagon tracks, though. He wasn't sure what had made the marks, but he was reasonably certain it was something the raiders had brought with them, then taken away again, because the marks turned and went back in the other direction. The place where they turned around was on top of a small ridge that commanded a good view of the ranch house. The kid sat there on the buckskin for a long moment, frowning as he thought about what he was looking at. An idea played around in the back of his mind, but he didn't know if there was any truth to it. The fires inside the buildings were starting to die down. The roofs had collapsed, but the adobe walls still stood. The kid rode back down there, dismounted, and started looking around for a shovel. He found one in a small shed that stood near the barn, but wasn't attached to it. The fire hadn't spread that far. He walked up a small aspen-dotted hill behind the ranch house that looked like it might be a good place to dig some graves. He figured Sean and Franny and Cyrus would like to be laid to rest overlooking the home where they had lived for too short a time. He hadn't started digging, though, when he heard a sudden rustling noise in some nearby brush. Instinct made the kid drop the shovel and whirl toward the sound, palming out his Colt as he did so.
Please, senor, help me.
Wary of a trap, the kid approached the brush carefully, gun in hand. He crouched, moved some branches aside, and saw a man he recognized as one of the Williams vaqueros lying there covered with blood. No one else was around. The kid holstered his gun and moved quickly to the injured man's side. One glance was enough to tell him that the vaquero was in the same shape as Sean Williams had been, shot to pieces and not long for this world.
Did you see the man who did this to you, amigo?
Los hombres, Señor Sean warned us about a dozen of them, maybe more. They had artillería.
You mean a cannon?
Sí, señor. Cannon. Dios mío.
Those were his final words. His head slumped to the side. His eyes were wide open and staring without seeing anything. The kid closed this man's eyes as he had Sean's, then came to his feet and looked down at the ranch house. A cannonball had caused the hole in the wall. The words of the dying vaquero had confirmed his suspicions. The cart on which the big gun was mounted had left those tracks. What sort of men would attack a peaceful ranch with a cannon and brutally wipe out a family that had done nothing wrong? Even as that question went through the kid's mind, he knew the answer. The sort of men who rode with Colonel Gideon Black. He had known as soon as he saw them that they were evil, cold-blooded killers. The colonel himself had seemed different, polite and well-spoken, but he had been in charge, and he had to know the kind of men who were riding with him. To the kid's way of thinking, that made Colonel Black just as bad or worse. The kid had no doubt that it was Black who had ordered the attack on the ranch after finding the bodies of the men buried under the bank of the arroyo. Black hadn't asked any questions. He had just assumed that those on the Williams ranch were responsible for the deaths of his men, and he had acted quickly and ruthlessly to settle the score for them. Colonel Black was going to discover that he wasn't the only one who could avenge some deaths. The kid intended to make the colonel and his men pay for what had happened there that morning. He didn't care how many of them there were, and he didn't give a damn that they had a cannon. The big gun didn't matter. Before this was over, the kid vowed as he stood on the hill and looked at the thinning smoke from the ruined ranch, there was going to be one hell of a big gun down. Bisbee, Arizona Territory, was nestled in the Mule Mountains, not far from the Mexican border. It was stretching a point to call the low peaks around them mountains, but in that generally flat country, the kids supposed they qualified. Dusk was settling down, and lights from the buildings were spread across the lower slopes. The discovery of copper in the area almost 20 years earlier had led to the founding of the settlement, and it had grown as miners realized that smaller quantities of gold and silver could be found along with the copper. The kid recalled that as Conrad Browning, he had owned a stake in a copper mine near there. Still did, he supposed, but he had never visited the operation, and it had represented nothing to him then except some figures on a balance sheet. Now it was even less than that to him. He had no reason to go there, at least none that he knew of. The first time Colonel Black came to the Williams Ranch, he had said that he and his men were headed up the San Pedro. That might have been a lie, or it might have been that the killers had indeed gone up the river and then returned to the ranch to wipe out the Williams family. Either way, the kid didn't know where they were now, and since he wanted to pick up their trail, the best place to start seemed to be Bisbee. He knew from what Sean and Franny had told him that the four men he'd killed on the ranch had been planning to rendezvous with Colonel Black in Bisbee. Somebody there would be able to tell him where to find the colonel. Once the kid knew that, his plan was simple. Kill the son of a bitch and everybody with him. It was all he could do for Sean, Franny, and Cyrus. In the early afternoon, he had found the bodies of mother and son in the charred ruins of the ranch house, once the heat had subsided enough for him to go inside. The ashes were still hot under his boots, so he moved quickly as he wrapped the bodies in blankets and carried them out to place them gently next to Sean's body. He had already dug seven graves up on the hillside. He was drenched with sweat, his muscles ached, and there was still work to be done. The metal framework of the wagon that had been inside the barn was still relatively intact. Only some of it was twisted from the heat of the flames. The kid shook out his rope, tied the vehicle to the buckskin, and used the horse to pull it out of the ruins. He found enough scraps of charred lumber and cobbled together a new bed for the wagon. Once he had done that, he placed the bodies on the wagon and used it to carry them up the hill to the grave sites. Earlier, he had spotted the basket where Cyrus had kept the pups. A glance into the basket told him that someone had emptied a six-gun into it. The kid took the basket up the hill, too, and put it into the grave with Cyrus. Then he started filling in the seven holes. It was mid-afternoon by the time he had finished, and he still had a long ride to Bisbee. But he paused long enough to stand for a moment over the graves. He wasn't a praying man. He didn't think El Señor Dios would look too kindly on words from a man who had so much blood on his hands. So he said to the people he had just buried,
"I can't make it right, but I can make the bastards pay."
He was settling his hat on his head when he saw movement down at the ranch. A couple of small dark shapes darted around the ruins. The kid frowned, wondering if they were rats. When he heard the faint yipping, he knew that he was looking at a couple of Cyrus's pups. Somehow, they had escaped the massacre of their brothers and sisters, probably off wandering around somewhere when the attack came. The kid thought about it for a long moment, then heaved a sigh. He had mounted up, rode down the hill, and called and whistled until the puppies came to him. He made room in his saddlebags, scooped them up, and put them in there. As the buckskin walked along Bisbee's main street a few hours later, they were still there, their heads sticking out of the top of the saddlebag as they looked around. They didn't weigh more than a few pounds each, little squirming bundles of black and gray and brown, and the kid didn't know what the hell he was going to do with them. All he knew was that he couldn't leave them on the death-haunted ranch to survive on their own. Cyrus wouldn't have wanted that. The kid angled the buckskin toward the hitch rail in front of a general store that was still open. He saw two men walking along the planks of the boardwalk toward the store, but didn't pay much attention to them as he dismounted. He took the pups out of the saddlebag and cradled them both in the crook of his left arm as he started up the steps to the high loading dock in front of the store.
Oh, would you look at that, Raleigh? Fella's got hisself some little dogs.
The kid glanced toward the men, saw them elbowing each other as they looked at him and the pups.
No, them ain't proper dogs, Paxton. Look how little they are. I think maybe they're prairie dogs.
You ever had fried prairie dog? It ain't bad.
Yeah, and I'm hungry. Say, mister, you want to sell us those little varmints? We'll fry them up and see how tasty they are.
The kid recognized the two men for what they were with a single look. Raleigh wore a Mexican sombrero with little balls dangling from the brim, while Paxton sported a dusty black suit and Stetson. Both men carried Colts and cut-down, tied-down holsters. Would-be hard cases and desperados, men who fancied themselves fast with their guns. They'd been drinking, but their steps were steady enough, and they didn't sway as they stood on the store's loading dock, grinning at the kid. The combination of all those things made them dangerous, although the kid wasn't particularly worried. He just didn't want to be bothered with them.
Sorry, boys, these pups aren't for sale. I'm looking for a good home for them, though.
We'll give them a good home.
Paxton rubbed his belly.
Hand them over, mister, and there won't be no trouble.
There won't be any trouble. I'm going in the store and the pups are coming with me.
What if we say they ain't?
Then you'll be wrong.
Well, you know who we are. You got any idea who you're messing with here, boy?
I think I do. A couple of damned fools looking for somebody to run roughshod over. Well, I have to tell you, I'm in no mood for it.
Why, you little pissant! You can't talk to us like that!
Sure as hell can't!
The kid took a step toward the store's entrance.
Go somewhere and finish getting drunk. And leave me alone while you're at it.
Oh, you son of a bitch!
Paxton and Raleigh both reached for their guns. Both men cleared level, but the kid's gun was level while their weapons were still coming up. Oh! The kid's shots sent both Paxton and Raleigh off the dock and onto the street. The kid glanced down at the pups to make sure they were all right and saw them staring up at him wide-eyed with almost human expressions.
Sorry, little guy.
He turned his attention back to the two men he just shot. Neither man was moving. The kid stepped over to the edge of the loading dock to take a closer look at Paxton, then used the toe of one of his boots to roll Raleigh onto his back. The man stared up sightlessly into the night. Bisbee had a reputation as a tough town. Most settlements that had sprung up because of their proximity to mines were like that. But even so, an outburst of gunfire was enough to draw considerable attention. A number of men converged on the general store to see what all the commotion was about. The kid glanced over his shoulder. He saw a man standing in the store's doorway, pointing a double-barreled shotgun at him.
I want to see both hands empty, mister. I'll blow you plumbing, too.
Take it easy, Sheriff.
The kid had spotted the badge pinned to the shotgunner's vest right away.
The shooting's over.
You're damn right it's over. If there's any more guns going off, it's going to be this greener of mine. I said, show me your hands.
The kid slid his Colt back in its holster. He didn't like pouching the iron without reloading it first, but under the circumstances, he supposed it was the best thing to do.
I'm not going to drop these pups. Can't very well shoot anybody with them, though, so I reckon you'll have to be satisfied with one empty hand.
The sheriff stepped out farther onto the loading dock.
Don't you get smart with me, boy. You're gonna march right down to my jail. I'm locking you up.
A tall, thick-bodied, balding man in an apron followed him onto the dock.
Why would you do that, Stuart? We both saw what happened. The stranger killed Paxton and Raleigh in self-defense.
I don't abide killings. I'm putting this fella behind bars until there's an inquest.
Yeah, well, you know what the coroner's jury is going to say. I'll testify that Paxton and Raleigh drew first and that the stranger was just defending himself. You'll be wasting your time and the county's money locking him up.
Sheriff Stewart turned his head to glare at the store owner. The kid figured that's who the man in the apron was.
I don't like anybody telling me how to do my job. You may be the mayor of Bisbee, Carmichael, but I work for the county, not the town.
I know that, and I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job. I'm just saying that it's pointless to put this man in jail tonight and turn him loose tomorrow.
He glanced at the bodies of the two dead gunmen.
Besides, nobody's going to lose any sleep over those two. They were born troublemakers.
Well, you're right about that.
Stewart looked at the kid again.
You planning on riding out of town tonight?
No. I'll be here for a day or two at least.
You'll be here until after the inquest tomorrow. That's for damn sure. And I want your word on it.
You got it.
The sheriff finally lowered his scatter gun. And once the twin barrels were pointed toward the ground, he eased the hammers back down. He was on the short side, a middle-aged man with a brushy mustache and what seemed to be a perpetual glare. He gave the kid a curt nod.
I'll fetch the undertaker. Don't you give him any more work while you're in Bisbee if you know what's good for you.
If the kid knew what was good for him, he wouldn't be in Bisbee on the trail of a gang of vicious, murdering sons of bitches armed with a damned cannon, of all things. But he didn't explain any of that to Sheriff Stewart. Instead, he just returned the lawman's nod. The store owner, Carmichael, motioned to the kid as Stewart headed up the street with the greener tucked under his arm.
You come on in. I'd like to talk to you.
The kid had been headed into the general store anyway, so he followed the proprietor inside. A few customers were clustered just inside the entrance, peering out curiously.
It's all over, folks. You can go on about your business now. Especially if your business is buying merchandise from me.
The little knot of people dispersed. Carmichael gestured for the kid to follow him toward the back of the store, where there was a long counter. Carmichael went behind it and pointed to a stool in front of it.
Have a seat, Mr.
Morgan.
You can set down the pups if you want. I don't think they'll get into too much trouble.
That's all right. They're pretty hungry. They might start looking for something to eat.
Well, we can take care of that. Got some beef scraps they can have. Are they big enough to eat something like that?
I don't know. They're not really my pups. I sort of inherited them. I'm looking for a good home for them, as well as some information.
About dogs?
About a man. Colonel Gideon Black.
I know the name. Don't really know the man, though. Don't want to, either.
Why not?
I don't want to say anything against the man in case he's your friend.
He's not. I never met the man. I promised some people I'd look him up, and I was told that he's been here in Bisbee lately.
That's true. He's been in and out of town several times in recent weeks. I don't really know the man myself, so I shouldn't make any judgments as to his character. I'm just going by the company he keeps.
Bad company, huh?
Carmichael nodded toward the street.
Those two gunnies you just tangled with out there.
Colonel Black's men?
Well, not really. They wanted to be, but I reckon Black turned them down. They didn't ride out with him the last time he left. Plenty of other hard cases did, though. That's why I don't care much for the colonel. He surrounded himself with gunmen. Outlaws and hired killers, if you ask me.
The kid nodded. So far, Carmichael hadn't really told him anything he didn't already know, except that Paxton and Raleigh had been would-be members of the colonel's gang, and that Black had found them wanting for some reason. They hadn't been fast enough and tough enough, more than likely, and Black had sensed that somehow. The kid hadn't had much trouble disposing of them. Black's men had to have more bark on them than those two.
You think he's liable to take offense at what happened to Raleigh and Paxton?
Well, I don't know. Like I said, they didn't actually ride with him. They are the reason I wanted to talk to you, though.
What about?
Carmichael placed his hands flat on the counter.
Well, there's getting to be more and more of that sort of men around here. Bisbee's always been a pretty rugged place, but it's getting worse. The county sheriff has always handled law and order here in town, too. But the town council and I have been thinking that it's time to hire a city marshal. To be blunt, I'd like to offer you the job, Mr. Morgan.
You just met me. You don't really know anything about me.
I know you're mighty slick on the draw, and you didn't even think about backing down when those two started to ride you. That's the sort of man we need to keep the peace here in Bisbee.
Sorry, Mayor. I'm not looking for a job right now. Not that kind, anyway.
That's right. You said you were planning to look up Colonel Black. I reckon maybe I misjudged you, Mr. Morgan.
Maybe you did. But I'm still looking for a good home for these pups.
Well, I might be able to help you out there. So happens I've got an 8-year-old grandson here in town, and I think he'd love to have a couple of fine little pups like these.
You'll take good care of them?
Well, I'll see to it.
Carmichael held out his hands, and the kid gave him the puppies. The storekeeper shook his head.
No offense, Mr. Morgan. But I never figured a man who can handle himself in a gunfight the way you did out there would be so worried about a couple of pups.
Like I said, I inherited them from somebody special. I want them to have a good life.
Well, they will. You have my word on it.
The kid nodded and started to turn away.
I'll probably be back before I leave town to stock up on some supplies.
You'll be welcome. And Mr. Morgan...
The kid looked at him.
I don't know why I'm doing this, but if you're bound and determined to meet up with Colonel Black... He spends a lot of time at a place called Augustine's when he's in town. It's a couple of blocks up on the right.
Thanks.
Don't thank me. Maybe I'm hoping that when the colonel finds out you killed Raleigh and Paxton, he'll try to even the score for them.
You're thinking that he'll kill me?
Or you'll kill him. Either way, I think Bisbee might be better off.
You could be right.
The kid headed up the street, leading the buckskin. It didn't take him long to spot Augustine's. The place was big and brightly lit, obviously one of the leading saloons in Bisbee. In a mining town like this, where there were probably more saloons than all the other businesses put together, That was saying something. After looping the buckskin's reins around a crowded hitch rail in front of Augustine's, the kid stepped out onto the boardwalk and pushed through the bat wings. Not surprisingly, it was loud and smoky inside the saloon. Chandeliers made from wagon wheels hung from the ceiling, each with half a dozen oil lamps mounted on it, casting a harsh glare over the big room. The long hardwood bar ran down the right side. Poker, faro, and roulette were set up on the left. The area in between was filled with tables and chairs, where miners with grimy faces and hands and equally grimy clothes sat and drank so they wouldn't think about the tedious, dangerous life they led underground. At the far end of the room, a staircase with an ornately carved banister led up to the second floor with its balcony that overhung the bar. As the kid paused just inside the saloon's entrance, he watched two whores in gaudy, spangled dresses leading customers upstairs, while a miner came down the stairs with a big grin on his face and fewer coins in his pocket. The kid had seen dozens of saloons like this, although, to be fair about it, Augustine's was one of the biggest and best furnished he had run across since he'd started drifting. Of course, it couldn't hold a candle to some of the establishments he had patronized in Boston, New York, Chicago, Denver, and San Francisco, back when he hadn't cared who knew that he was a rich man. He was still a rich man, but he didn't flaunt his wealth now. Just like his father, the money was important to him only because it allowed him to keep drifting without having to worry about how he was going to pay for his next meal or the supplies to carry him over the next hill. He spotted an empty place at the bar and started toward it. It had been a long, terrible day, and he intended to chase away not only his thirst, but also some of his weariness with a mug of what a sign over the bar proclaimed to be ice-cold beer. Before he could reach the bar, though, a man ran into his shoulder.
Watch where you're going.
The man was a miner, a tall man whose shirt bulged from the massive slab-like muscles on his arms and shoulders, muscles that had developed from years of working with a pick and shovel.
You're the one who should watch your step, mister.
What the hell did you just say to me?
I said you should watch your step.
The kid nodded toward the bar.
And while we were talking, someone else got that empty spot we were both after.
Blast it! If you hadn't run into me, you American lout, I'd be there drinking now.
The kid didn't care for that American lout comment. After all, the miner was over here working in an American mine, being paid American wages. If he hadn't cared for the country and its citizens, he could always go back where he came from. But the kid wasn't going to start a fight. He started to step around the miner.
There's room for all of us.
The man's hand came down hard on his shoulder.
No, there ain't.
He hauled the kid around and started to swing a mallet-like fist at his head. The crowd around the two men suddenly began to clear as the saloon's customers scrambled to get out of the way. The kid weaved to the side and let the big fist sail harmlessly past his ear. He stepped in and hooked a right into the miner's belly. Punch was like punching a brick wall. The man just grinned at him, grabbed him by both shoulders, and flung him hard against the bar. The edge of the hardwood caught the kid in the back, forcing him to bend over backwards. The miner laced his fingers together and lunged at the kid, bringing both hands up and swinging them like a club at the young gunfighter's head. The kid recovered just in time to roll away from what would have been a devastating blow. The miner's fists crashed down on the hardwood. The kid pushed away from the bar and threw a punch of his own. It caught the miner on the ear. The man waded in, swinging wild punches. The kid was able to block some of the blows, but some of them got through and rocked him. Luckily, the punches that landed were all to his body. If any of the miner's headshots had connected, in all likelihood, the fight would have been over. As it was, the kid was pinned back against the bar. He was vaguely aware that everyone in the saloon was shouting. They were probably yelling encouragement to his opponent, since the other miners would know him and the kid was a stranger. As he tried to slide along the bar and shift position, his left leg suddenly threatened to buckle. He had worked hard and then ridden a long way, and it had been less than a week since he'd been shot. The little lurch he'd made when his leg twinged had caused one of the miner's punches to miss. The man was close, his breath hot in the kid's face. The kid lifted his right fist in a vicious uppercut that landed cleanly under the miner's chin. It might not have done too much damage if the tip of the man's tongue hadn't been protruding between his front teeth at that instant. But as it was, those teeth came together sharply, and blood spurted as they bit completely through the tongue, severing about a quarter of an inch from the tip. The miner staggered back as blood bubbled over his lips from the mutilated tongue. The kid went after him, not giving the miner a chance to recover. He swung a left and a right and another left to the man's jaw, rocking his head back and forth with each punch. A stiff right jab landed on the miner's mouth. The kid kicked him in the knee, and as the miner started to bend over, the kid bulled into him, driving him backward. The miner lost his balance and fell, landing on his back on a table that collapsed under him. He lay there stunned, with his bloody tongue sticking out of his mouth. Chest heaving, the kid looked around. All he saw were unfriendly faces. He had been right in his guess about the shouts. The sentiment in the saloon was definitely against him.
That'll be enough, gentlemen.
A stocky, heavy-jawed man in a dark suit came along the bar. The miner stepped back to let him by, even though he was unarmed and smaller than most of them. Judging by the man's expensive clothes and the air of command about him, the kid pegged him as the owner of the saloon. As such, the miners wouldn't want to cross him, even though he was interfering with their fun.
Next round is on the house.
That offer was enough to defuse the situation. The miners dragged their fallen comrade into a corner and propped him up at a table. One of them reached down and picked up something from the floor, regarding it intently for a moment before he flicked it into a spittoon. The kid knew that the item was the bitten-off tip of the miner's tongue. Oh well, the hombre didn't have any use for it anymore.
I'm Charles Augustine.
The man stood in front of the kid.
Why don't you come with me? I'd like to buy you a drink.
The kid looked around until he spotted his hat lying on the floor. He picked it up and settled it on his head.
That's liable to get you in bad with this bunch.
You think I'm worried about that? I have the coldest beer, the finest whiskey, and the prettiest whores in Bisbee. As long as those three things are true, those miners don't care what I do.
The kid knew that was probably true. He followed Augustine through the surly crowd. No one tried to stop them or even slow them down. Augustine led him through a door at the end of the bar, along a short hallway, and through another door into an opulently furnished office dominated by a big desk and a square massive safe. Augustine went to a small bar in the corner and picked up a crystal decanter half filled with amber liquid.
Brandy all right?
Fine.
He had come into the saloon to get a beer and maybe find out something about Colonel Gideon Black, and instead his temper and some bad luck had gotten him into a brawl. He would settle for brandy instead of the beer, but he still hoped for some information about the man he was looking for. Augustine poured brandy into a couple of snifters and brought them over to the kid, who took one of them. Augustine clinked the glasses together.
To the best fight I've seen in here in, at least a week.
The kid sipped the brandy. It was like liquid fire and kindled a welcome blaze in his belly.
You have a lot of fights in here?
I don't discourage them. I always collect damages from the mining companies, if not from the miners themselves. They like to blow off steam when they come to town. A little fracas every now and then is good for business.
The kid nodded and took another sip of the brandy. He noticed Augustine studying him with a canny expression, but didn't really think anything about it until the saloon owner said,
"You're not who you're pretending to be."
What are you talking about? I haven't even told you my name yet.
Augustine waved a well-manicured hand.
Your name doesn't matter. You come in here wearing buckskins and boots and a big hat, and you got a Colt strapped on like you're some sort of gunslinger. But you sip that brandy like a cultured man who's tasted fine liquor before.
You got me all wrong, Mr. Augustine. I'm just a drifter.
Have it your way. So, tell me what you're calling yourself.
Morgan.
Augustine lifted his snifter of brandy in a salute.
I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Morgan. It's not every man who can take Clyde Watkins in a bare-knuckles fight. In fact, I'm not sure anyone in these parts has ever done that before.
That'd be that miner downstairs?
That's right.
There was a little bit of luck involved. If he hadn't bitten off the end of his tongue, I'm not sure I would have been able to put him down.
I'm not sure I believe in luck. Strange thing for a gambler to say, isn't it?
The kid lifted his glass in acknowledgement of that point and took another sip.
Over time, the man who's the best at what he does always prevails. That's why I like to surround myself with talented people, whether those talents involve dealing cards or dealing other things.
Are you working your way around to offering me a job, Mr. Augustine?
Would that bother you?
No, but I'd turn it down, just like I turned down Mayor Carmichael when he wanted to pin a city marshal's badge on me.
You're the man who killed Raleigh and Paxton over in front of Carmichael's store.
News travels fast.
I heard about it almost as soon as it happened. I make it my business to hear about everything that goes on in Bisbee. I didn't know until now that you were involved in that shooting, though. That makes me even happier that I asked you to come back here and have a drink with me.
I told you, I'm not looking for a job.
And I'm not offering you one. But I know someone who might. And you'd be wise to reserve judgment on whether or not you'll accept, Mr. Morgan. Have you ever heard of a man named Edward Sheffield?
Now it was the kid's turn to be taken by surprise. He had expected Augustine to steer him toward Colonel Gideon Black, since, according to Mayor Carmichael, Black spent considerable time at the saloon whenever he was in Bisbee. Augustine hadn't mentioned Black at all, though. Instead, he had thrown out a name that was indeed familiar to Kid Morgan. Or at least, Edward Sheffield's name was familiar to Conrad Browning. Edward Sheffield was a financier who also dabbled in railroads and mining, among other enterprises. He and Conrad had held seats on the boards of some of the same companies, but never at the same time. So while the kid knew the name, he had never actually met Sheffield.
Some sort of big business tycoon, isn't he?
You could say that. Between the railroads and the mines, he's played a large part in developing this part of the territory. He has a very successful copper mine up in the Dragoons that also produces significant amounts of gold and silver. There's a town up there, Titusville, named after Mr. Sheffield's father, that he owns pretty much lock, stock, and barrel. And he's built a spur line from the Southern Pacific here at Bisbee all the way to Titusville to carry in supplies and carry out the ore from the mine.
The kid hadn't heard about any of that. He supposed they were fairly recent developments in Sheffield's career.
Sounds like he's pretty successful. I don't see what that has to do with me, though.
I happen to know that Mr. Sheffield is having some trouble. Outlaw trouble. And he's looking for somebody to do something about it.
You mean he's looking for hired guns?
Not just hired guns. He needs someone to take charge of the effort to wipe out those desperados.
And you think I could be that man?
You're fast enough on the draw to kill a couple of men who were pretty gun handy, and tough enough to chop down a miner who's been known to take on 3 or 4 men at once and thrash them all. I think you're exactly what Edward Sheffield is looking for. I think you should talk to him anyway.
The kid was about to repeat that he wasn't looking for a job when a hunch occurred to him.
These outlaws, what do you know about them?
Nobody knows much of anything, but I have my suspicions. I think they're led by an ex-army colonel who's turned renegade, a man named Gideon Black.
The kid didn't allow any reaction to show on his face.
I've heard of him.
He's been around these parts for a while. Sheriff Stewart doesn't have any proof that Black's involved in anything illegal, but from the looks of it, Black's been recruiting hard cases and putting together a pretty good-sized gang. Mr. Sheffield thinks that they're the ones who have held up a couple of his trains.
I didn't know that. I'd heard that Black was looking for some good men, though. As a matter of fact, that's why I'm here.
Then I may have spoken out of turn if you're planning on joining up with the Colonel.
I haven't made any plans. Just heard the rumors and drifted into town to get the lay of the land. I'm open to the best opportunity, whatever it is.
Then you'll want to talk to Edward Sheffield. He'll pay top dollar for a man who can put a stop to his trouble.
You know, Mayor Carmichael told me that Black's been spending a lot of time in your place, Augustine. I got the impression that you and the Colonel were friends. Now it seems more like you'd rather give Sheffield a hand.
Just like you, Mr. Morgan, I'm open to the best opportunity. If Colonel Black and his men want to spend their money in my saloon, I'm perfectly willing to take it. At the same time, I wouldn't mind getting on the good side of a man like Edward Sheffield. As I told you, he's probably the most important man in this part of the territory.
In other words, you're playing both sides against the middle.
Say it however you like. I've never apologized for wanting to make money, and I'm not going to start now.
Fair enough. Where do I find this man Sheffield?
You just got into Bisbee a little while ago, didn't you, Mr. Morgan?
That's right. About an hour ago, I reckon.
It seemed longer than that, the kid thought. But it also seemed beyond belief that only this morning, the Williams family and their vaqueros had still been alive and happy. This day, full of violence and death, had lasted 100 years.
Why don't you get yourself something to eat and maybe find a hotel room, then come back here in about an hour? The Bisbee House would suit all those needs, since it's the best hotel in town, and also has a fine dining room. And a stable for your horse, for that matter.
How do you know I can afford a place like that?
I don't, of course. But I assume that a man who's familiar with fine brandy would also be accustomed to staying in the best places.
All right, I'll check it out. My horse could use a good rub down and something to eat. I suppose you want to send word to Sheffield and find out if it's all right for me to meet with him. Folks must tread lightly around him since he's the big man in these parts.
That's right. But for what it's worth, Mr. Morgan, I'll put in a good word for you. I thought the way you handled Watkins was quite impressive, to say nothing of that shootout with Raleigh and Paxton. As gunmen, they weren't quite at the same level as the men who ride with Colonel Black, but they were no slouches either.
All right, then. I'll be back in an hour or so.
The kid turned toward the door of the office.
I'd better come with you. There may still be some resentment on the part of the miners over what happened to Watkins.
The kid didn't argue with him. They walked out together. The kid was aware of the angry glares sent in his direction by many of the saloon's customers. He saw Watkins still sitting at one of the tables. A man in a bowler hat was working on his tongue, either sewing it up or bandaging it or something. The black medical bag sitting open on the table told the kid that the man in the bowler was a doctor. Augustine paused on the boardwalk just outside the saloon's batwing doors.
The Bisbee House is in the next block. You can't miss it.
Thanks for the brandy, and for that good word you're going to put in with Sheffield.
I don't know that I'm doing you that much of a favor. If you take the job, you'll be going up against heavy odds. I don't know how many men the colonel has now, but it could be more than 24.
Plus a cannon, thought the kid. Those were heavy odds, all right. Luckily, he didn't give a damn about things like that. The Bisbee House was a fine hotel, as Charles Augustine had said. A 3-story building of adobe and brick, the upper 2 stories had wrought iron balconies along the front that overhung a broad porch where guests could sit in wicker chairs and sip drinks in the shade during the heat of the day. Gas lamps filled the lobby with warm yellow light that gleamed on the brilliantly polished hardwood floors. Potted palms stood in the corners. Men in expensive suits sat on overstuffed divans and armchairs reading newspapers. The place had the hushed atmosphere that came with money and power. For that reason, the clerk at the desk looked a little askance at the kid's buckskin shirt, denim trousers, high-topped boots, and broad-brimmed hat. The fact that he had a pair of saddlebags slung over his shoulder and was carrying a Winchester didn't help matters either. The clerk put his hands on the desk and leaned forward.
Sir, I'm not sure...
I am. I'll have a room, and I need someone to take my horse around to the stable and see that he's tended to. He's the big buckskin tied up right out front.
The kid glanced through an arched doorway and saw people eating off fine china at tables covered with snowy linen tablecloths.
Good. The dining room is still open.
Sir, I'm afraid I must insist...
On giving me the best accommodations in the house? I appreciate that.
The kid reached in his pocket and brought out several $20 gold pieces, which he stacked neatly on the desk in front of the surprised clerk.
There's $100. Let me know when it runs out.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, pick one of them up and bite it. I know you're dying to.
No, sir. I'm sure your money is good. You say your horse is a buckskin?
That's right.
I'll have it taken care of, sir.
The clerk turned the register around.
If you'd care to sign.
The kid hesitated before reaching for the pen that rested in a holder with a black marble base. He didn't want to use the name Conrad Browning. He had put all that behind him. Most of the time, it seemed to him like Conrad Browning was a completely different person. Besides, just as he had recognized Edward Sheffield's name, it was highly likely that Sheffield had heard of Conrad. He didn't want word getting to Sheffield that Browning was in town. Somehow, it didn't seem right, though, to sign in as Kid Morgan. He had dubbed that dime novelesque name on himself when he wanted the world to believe that Conrad Browning was dead, and the handle had stuck. The kid had grown comfortable with it, and it was something of a tribute to his father as well. But there was no getting around the fact that it was a little, well, melodramatic. He settled for scrawling K. Morgan in the register, and in the space for his home address, he wrote San Francisco. That's where the offices of Turnbuckle and Stafford were, and that was as close to a home as the kid had these days.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. If you need any help with your bags...
I don't. This is all I have. Just see to the horse.
Of course, sir.
It was amazing how much difference a stack of double eagles made in the way a man was treated, the kid mused. The clerk handed him the key to room 28.
It's right on the front, with a fine view of the street.
From what the kid had seen, the main street of Bisbee wasn't all that scenic. But he took the key and nodded.
Much obliged.
A porter responded to the bell, and the clerk told him to get the kid's horse and take it around back to the stable.
See that he's well taken care of.
Yes, sir.
The porter grinned when the kid pressed a 50-cent piece into his hand. The kid was aware that some of the guests in the lobby were watching him curiously. To the eyes of those well-to-do businessmen, he wasn't the sort of man who normally patronized the Bisbee House. He felt them watching him as he went up the stairs carrying his rifle and saddlebags. He climbed 2 flights and found room 28 on the front of the hotel where the clerk had said it would be. The corridor had a thick carpet runner down the center of it, prints of landscape paintings on the walls and ornate gas lamp fixtures. The room itself was more of the same, except there was a large woven rug instead of the carpet runner. The paper on the walls had gold flecks in it. A pitcher and a basin sat on a washstand. The bed was heavy, the mattress thick. A wave of weariness came over him as he looked at it, and he wanted to just crawl into the bed and stay there for the next 14 or 15 hours. Instead, he placed the Winchester and the saddlebags on the bed, tossed his hat beside him, and peeled off the buckskin shirt. He wanted to wash off the grime of the day. When he had washed up as best as he could, he pulled a white shirt, black whipcord trousers, and a black vest and jacket out of the saddlebags. After shaking the wrinkles out of them, he donned them and then wrapped a black string tie around his neck. He looked considerably different than when he had ridden into town. This garb was simple, far from the dandified get-ups he had worn as Conrad Browning, but it was more respectable than the trail clothes he usually wore. He wouldn't look as out of place in the hotel dining room or when he met with Edward Sheffield. Not that the kid gave a damn what people thought of him. The events of the past year had taught him how meaningless such things were. But he had already killed two men and had a knockdown, drag-out fight with another since his arrival in Bisbee, and he figured he had attracted enough attention to himself for the time being. He wasn't going unarmed, though. That would be too much, he thought, as he strapped the gun belt around his hips. When he went back downstairs, the clerk glanced at him and then looked away, evidently not recognizing him. Then the man looked again, clearly surprised as he realized who the tall man in the dark suit was.
Mr. Morgan, the dining room's right through there.
Thanks.
He went into the dining room and sat at one of the tables with its snowy linen cloth. A pretty brown-haired waitress came over and smiled at him, not bothering to keep the admiration and interest out of her eyes as she asked him what she could get him. Morgan's tone was businesslike as he ordered steak with all the trimmings and coffee. He was hungry. He hadn't had much to eat that day, and the brandy, on an empty stomach he'd had at Augustine's, was making his brain a little fuzzy. The food and coffee would take care of that. The meal was a good one, and by the time Morgan finished with it, he felt human again. The hard, grim day had taken a toll on him, but he felt like he could keep going for a while now. The waitress hovered around his table.
Are you sure there's nothing else you'd like, sir?
Not a thing.
Morgan knew that if he'd been of a mind to, he could have flirted with the waitress, and there was no telling how far it would have gotten him. But that was about the last thing he wanted right now. And besides, he had an appointment with Charles Augustine. The saloon owner was going to take him to meet Edward Sheffield, and Morgan hoped that Sheffield would help him find Colonel Gideon Black and even the score for the Williams family. He signed for the meal, then stood up and put on his hat. As he walked onto Bisbee's main street, he saw that the town was even livelier now that it was a little later in the evening. The saloons appeared to be doing a booming business, and the stores that were still open, including Carmichael's Mercantile, had customers going in and out of them, too. Morgan thought briefly about the puppies he had brought from the ranch, and hoped that Carmichael's grandson took good care of them. Then he put that out of his head and strolled toward Augustine's. As he entered the saloon, Morgan noted the big miner with whom he had clashed earlier was gone, or at least not at the same table where he had been. Surely some of the other customers who had glared murderously at him as he left were still there, but they didn't pay any attention to him. It was another reason he had changed clothes. He wasn't trying to duck trouble, but it didn't make sense to go out of his way to find it either. He made his way along the crowded bar to the door at the end of it. As he reached for the knob, one of the bartenders came down to that end of the bar.
Hold him, mister. You can't just...
Morgan looked at him coldly.
Mr. Augustine is expecting me.
Then you just go right ahead, sir. Sorry I bothered you.
No bother.
Morgan opened the door and stepped into the corridor. When he reached the door at the other end, he knocked on it.
Who's there?
Morgan.
Ah, come in.
When Morgan opened the door, he saw Augustine taking his right hand out from under his coat. He had a hunch that the saloon keeper's fingers had been wrapped around the butt of a pistol in a shoulder rig. No man was as successful in a mining boom town as Augustine appeared to be, without making a considerable number of enemies along the way. Augustine smiled as he got to his feet. He didn't comment on Morgan's changed appearance.
Are you ready to meet Edward Sheffield?
That's why I'm here, but I don't see him.
Oh, he's not here. We'll have to go see him. That's the way it works.
Morgan wasn't surprised. Rich men were accustomed to people coming to them, rather than the other way around. Augustine took a soft felt hat from a hat tree.
We'll go out the back. You didn't have any trouble when you came in, did you?
Not a bit.
How do you like the Bisbee house?
It's fine. Looks comfortable, and the food in the dining room was good.
I'm glad you liked it.
He led the way into the corridor, where he opened another door that led them into an alley. Morgan stayed close to him, not expecting any sort of a double cross, but knowing at the same time that it would be more difficult to ambush him if there wasn't much distance between him and Augustine. He realized after a few minutes that they were walking toward the train station. Recalling what Augustine had said about Edward Sheffield building a spur line into the Dragoon Mountains to serve the company town near his mine, Morgan wondered if he would have to go all the way to Titusville to meet with Sheffield. Surely Augustine would have told him if that were the case, so that he could have brought his gear along with him. That wasn't how it turned out, however. When they reached the depot, Augustine gestured toward a couple of railroad cars parked on a siding.
There it is. Edward Sheffield's home away from home.
Morgan wasn't particularly surprised. He knew that a lot of tycoons had their own private railroad cars. When he was still Conrad Browning, he might have enjoyed such a thing himself. The two of them went up a set of iron steps to the platform at the rear of the closest car, which was a thing of beauty, all polished brass and dark wood. Augustine knocked on the vestibule door, which was opened a moment later by a stout woman in a maid's uniform.
Herr Augustine, please come in. Herr Sheffield is waiting for you.
He hasn't been waiting long, I hope.
Ach, no. He and Frau Sheffield just finished their dinner a few minutes ago.
Morgan thought back, trying to remember what, if anything, he had ever heard about Sheffield's wife. He didn't recall much, only that she was in bad health. He wondered if she had come to Arizona Territory with her husband because of the warm, dry climate. Sheffield's home was in Chicago, Morgan remembered. The winters there would be hard on someone who was sick. The maid took their hats and led them through the vestibule into an elegantly appointed sitting room. Morgan had seen plenty of hotel rooms that weren't as elegantly and comfortably furnished as this railroad car. A slender man rose from a divan to greet them. He held a drink in one hand, a long, thick cigar in the other. His gray hair was parted in the center and thinning on top. He had a mustache and rather bushy mutton chop whiskers.
Augustine, this is the man you mentioned in the note you had delivered to me?
That's right, Mr. Sheffield. This is Mr. Morgan.
No first name?
He looked at Morgan with a challenge in his eyes.
Morgan will do.
All right, then.
He stuck the cigar in his mouth, clamped down on it with his teeth, and extended his hand.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Morgan.
Same here.
Sheffield didn't offer him a drink, which wasn't surprising. This wasn't a meeting of equals. Sheffield was deciding whether or not to hire him. The man also didn't waste any time getting down to business.
Did Charles here tell you about the trouble I've been having?
He said that some outlaws have been giving you problems.
Sheffield took the cigar out of his mouth and tossed back the whiskey that was still in his glass.
That's right. I run a private train between here and Titusville in the Dragoon Mountains. It's been stopped a couple of times by bandits. Passengers robbed, gold and silver shipments looted.
I thought you made most of your money out of copper.
That's right. The Gloriana is primarily a copper mine, but we take out significant amounts of gold and silver, too. You don't have to have a very big shipment of those ores for its value to amount to something.
No, I imagine not. Go ahead.
I've put extra guards on the trains, but I think it's only a matter of time before those outlaws strike again. I want them stopped before that happens. Not only that, I also want them brought to justice for the crimes they've already committed.
Morgan didn't figure justice had a whole lot to do with it. Sheffield wanted vengeance because someone had dared to cross him. There was something else going on there, too.
I imagine you'd like to have that stolen gold and silver back, if anything's left of it, that is.
Of course, it's mine.
And that was the crux of it, Morgan thought. Sheffield couldn't stand anybody taking anything away from him. Morgan knew that, because there had been a time in his life when he had felt the same way, until someone took away everything that really mattered.
What do I have to do with this?
Sheffield gestured with the cigar toward the Colt on Morgan's hip.
Augustine tells me that you killed two men earlier this evening in a gunfight.
They drew on me. I didn't have much choice in the matter.
Still, two against one. Most men facing those odds would be dead now.
Morgan didn't say anything, just met Sheffield's eyes with a level stare.
Not only that, but you had some trouble with one of the men who worked for me at the mine.
Clyde Watkins. He didn't give me much choice either.
Watkins has a reputation for violence. Since he's been at the Gloriana, no one has ever defeated him in a brawl. Is there anything you can't do, Morgan?
Plenty.
Well, no need to beat around the bush. I've hired guards, but what I really need is a hunter. Someone to hunt down those outlaws and deal with them.
Deal with them harshly?
Deal with them however is necessary to ensure that they never bother me or anyone else again. Whatever it takes.
And you want me to be that hunter?
I think it's a job you can handle, kid.
Morgan wasn't really surprised that Sheffield had already looked into his background and discovered who he was. Not who he really was, or rather had been, of course. But he knew that Kid Morgan had developed quite a reputation as a fighting man in a short period of time.
You're Kid Morgan?
That's what some people call me.
That didn't occur to me. When I heard your name, my first thought was about Frank Morgan, the famous gunman, but I knew you were too young to be him.
Our young friend is a different Morgan, Charles, but no less notorious.
I wouldn't say that. Frank Morgan has had a lot more time to build his reputation.
But he's not here, and you are. I'm not sure he's even still alive. I need help now, Morgan. I need someone to track down that damned colonel.
Colonel Gideon Black?
That's right. Charles told me that you came to Bisbee with the idea that you might join his gang.
I heard Black was looking for men who were good with a gun. That's all. I didn't know he was putting together a gang to hold up your trains.
And that makes a difference, doesn't it? You have a reputation as a gunman and a killer, but not as a desperado.
I'd just as soon be on the right side of the law if I can, so I won't have to spend the rest of my life looking over my shoulder for every sheriff and marshal and bounty hunter who'd like to take me in.
Then it doesn't matter what brought you here. Take the job I'm offering you, Morgan. Hunt down Gideon Black and his gang and destroy them. I can provide you with men, weapons, horses, whatever you need.
Morgan didn't answer right away. He wasn't just pretending to be reluctant. He honestly didn't know whether he wanted to get involved with Edward Sheffield's problems. If he took the job Sheffield was offering him, then the tycoon would expect to be in charge of the campaign against Colonel Black. Morgan didn't much like the idea of taking orders from the man. In truth, he didn't much like Sheffield, period. And he wasn't that sympathetic about Sheffield's problems. He just wanted to settle the score with Black for what had happened that morning at the isolated ranch west of there.
Well, Morgan, what's it going to be?
Suddenly, the door at the far end of the car opened.
If Mr. Morgan needs some convincing to accept your offer, Edward, maybe I could help.
Morgan turned his head to look toward the newcomer. The sight that met his eyes wasn't what he expected at all. If it wasn't for the fact that the young woman had called the tycoon Edward, Morgan might have thought that she was Sheffield's daughter. She didn't appear to be more than 25 years old. A bottle green dress was buttoned up to her neck, but the decorous cut of the gown couldn't conceal the way it hugged a tall, sleek, well-curved body. Thick red hair was pulled back into an elaborate arrangement of curls behind her head. Green eyes met Morgan's gaze with an undisguised boldness. Of course, calling Sheffield by his first name didn't have to mean anything, Morgan reminded himself. He called his father Frank, after all. The young woman came forward.
Mr. Morgan, my wife.
Morgan nodded to her.
Mrs. Sheffield?
He knew good and well this beautiful young woman wasn't the semi-invalid Sheffield had been married to a few years earlier. She stepped up to him and extended her hand.
I'm Gloriana.
He glanced at Sheffield as he took her hand.
Your husband's mine is named after you.
She smiled as she clasped his hand with a firm pressure. Her hand was cool and smooth.
Of course. Edward named the mine after me. Or renamed it, I should say. It used to be called something else. But when we married last year, that was one of his presents to me. Oh, by the way, you can call me Glory.
She held onto his hand too long, and Morgan carefully disengaged his fingers from her grip. He saw a flicker of disappointment in her eyes, but the radiant smile on her face never wavered.
We're discussing business here, my dear.
I'm aware of that. You know how interested I am in your business, darling. I may be quite decorative, but I do have a brain, too.
Of course you do, but I prefer to keep my business and personal lives separate. So if you'll excuse us...
Well, just go ahead with what you were talking about. I'll just sit over here.
She moved to a divan and sat down, where she continued to smile with maddening boldness at Morgan. Her husband's jaw tightened, but he turned back to Morgan and made a visible effort to ignore the fact that his wife was still in the room.
Now, what about it, Morgan? Will you take the job?
You'd be putting a lot of faith in somebody you just met.
I didn't get where I am by being timid, or by not trusting my instincts. I'm an excellent judge of character. I can tell that you're the man I need to run this renegade colonel to ground. What do you say?
It was a tempting offer. Sheffield could place a lot of resources at his disposal. The problem was that Sheffield wanted what amounted to a military campaign carried out against Colonel Black and his men, and Morgan wasn't a general. He had never even been in the army, and while he had felt comfortable enough issuing orders in a business setting, this was different. This was life and death. He didn't want that responsibility. Still, Sheffield might prove useful in locating the colonel. Morgan didn't want to turn him down flat. So, instead of answering Sheffield's question...
When are you going up to Titusville?
Actually, I'm scheduled to visit the mine tomorrow. My cars will be hooked onto a train that's leaving at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Let me come with you.
Then you're accepting my offer?
Not just yet. I want to get the lay of the land first.
See here, I'm not accustomed to people stonewalling me like this. Give me a simple yes or no answer, blast it.
I don't think Mr. Morgan is stonewalling, Edward. He's just being cautious. Why don't we take him up to Titusville with us tomorrow, as he suggested? That way, he can get the lay of the land, as he put it.
I suppose we could finish our discussion in Titusville after you've had a chance to look around. But don't postpone your decision too long, Morgan. I'm not the most patient man in the world.
Glory got to her feet, uncoiling from the divan like a cat.
Now that you gentlemen have concluded your business for the time being, I think we should all have a drink.
Sheffield looked like he didn't care for that idea. He didn't drink with the hired help, after all. But evidently, he didn't want to be ungracious. He shrugged.
All right. Morgan? Augustine?
That sounds mighty fine to me, Mr. Sheffield.
Thanks.
Sheffield gestured curtly to the German maid, who had come into the room unobtrusively behind Glory. She poured the drinks and handed them around. Glory lifted her glass, smiled at Morgan.
To new friends.
Morgan returned the smile, but didn't say anything. He wasn't the least bit interested in Glory Sheffield, although he was mildly curious about how she had come to be married to the mining and railing tycoon, as well as what had happened to Sheffield's first wife. Edith, that was her name, Morgan recalled suddenly. She must have passed away, and Sheffield had wasted no time in remarrying. Sheffield threw back his drink. The nod he then gave to Morgan was one of dismissal.
We're much obliged to you for your time, Mr. Sheffield. I hope things work out for you and Mr. Morgan, and that you get those blasted outlaws taken care of.
Glory moved closer to Morgan and rested a hand lightly on his arm.
Don't be late in the morning, Mr. Morgan. I'd hate it if we had to leave without you.
I'll be here.
Good. I'm looking forward to getting to know you better. It takes several hours for the train to reach Titusville, so we'll have plenty of time to get acquainted.
Morgan didn't know what to say to that. So he didn't say anything.